We're going to see if I teach or if we just wait all night for the board. If you were here last week, what cult did we cover last week?
Scientology.
And you know, Scientology continues to be in the news. Now there are intimations that Tom Cruise is the latest prophet, that he is actually being heralded by some of the church leaders as a prophet. Well, salvation is at hand. That he is actually a prophet. You know, it's interesting that L. Ron Hubbard never claimed to be a prophet. L. Ron Hubbard said that his message was from that Thetan, that space-traveling alien, but L. Ron Hubbard never claimed to be a prophet. There are no prophets. Why can't there be a prophet? Oh, that's great. Do we have the wheel?
Yeah, it's coming.
Okay. Okay. That's okay. They're not good, but they're free, and so that's. There we go. Thank you, gentlemen. But you know, there can't be a prophet unless there's a God, because unless there's a God, there's no one to give you a message about the future. And Scientologists tell us that you can't predict the future or prophesy against about the future, because the future is constantly evolving. The future is static. It never stays the same. And so for a Scientologist now to say, well, Tom Cruise is the next prophet, that goes entirely contrary to the teachings of their founder, L. Ron Hubbard. You know, it's interesting, whenever you deal with a cult, remember, are there any extras? Do we have any more? Do we have any? We got a couple back here. If you don't have an outline for tonight, raise your hand. We got a couple back there in the corner. We got a couple here. Raise your hand if you haven't gotten one of these. One of the things to remember when you look at a cult is that it has a constantly evolving theology. What that cult teaches today will not be what that cult teaches in 50 years. What that cult teaches today is not what that cult taught 50 years ago. Cults have a constantly changing, evolving body of doctrine. That's true of every single cult. That's just one of the things that distinguishes Christianity from a cult. We have the same unchanging Word of God that has existed from the Old Testament through the New. Our Bible doesn't change. Our teachings don't change. With cults, you always have a change. You know, last week we took 40 minutes to crash through 50 years of Scientology. And I thought, that's ridiculous to have to go through 50 years in 40 minutes. So my wife said, what are you doing tonight? I said, 1,500 years in 40 minutes. We're talking about Islam. We're talking about Islam. When I was growing up, you didn't even hear about Islam. Those were just the crazy people who lived over in the Mideast. Islam, the word means submit. That is the translation. Muslim is translated one who submits. That's the command. That's the response. That's the cult. That is the command and demand of the cult. Islam is submit. Muslim is one who submits. We're going to look too briefly at the history of Islam because, again, it's been around for 1,500 years. So it has some history. It has some legs. And as we've talked about before, in our human mindset, it's like the longer something is around, the more credibility it gains just because of longevity. You know, and while we do well to take those things into account, we're to respect our elders, and the older I get, the more I appreciate that command from the Bible. We still can't just automatically ascribe validity because something's old. Muhammad was born around 570 A.D. So he was born nearly 600 years after the death of Christ. By the time he's born, the canon of Scripture is closed. We know the canon of Scripture closed about 93 A.D. Book of Revelation, John. We know the story. So the canon's been closed for about 400 years, and the teachings have been disseminated widely through the known world by that time. Muhammad's born in the town of Mecca. And Mecca was an ancient town even when he was born. It had been around for literally centuries, about 1,000 years by the time Muhammad was born. It's still around. Mecca is in modern-day Saudi Arabia on the coast of the Red Sea. It's still a big tourist destination. It was a big tourist destination when Muhammad was born. It was a religious tourist destination. Mecca had shrines to just all these gods. And people would travel from all over that part of the world to Mecca. And they had a real thriving industry. It was kind of like Orlando, Florida without rides. But, you know, why would you go to Orlando, Florida without the rides? The biggest attraction in Mecca was, and still remains, the Kaaba. The Kaaba is a cube constructed right outside a town. It has two walls that are about 35 feet tall, one wall that's 40 feet tall, one wall that's 50 feet tall. Obviously not an engineer available when they built this thing. The most important thing about the Kaaba is inside it, there's this black stone. Nobody knows where this black stone came from. When Muhammad was born, the black stone had been there for centuries. Its origin had been obscured in the clouds of time. But it was a mystical black stone. It was a magical black stone. And people would come from all over the area to touch the black stone. And, you know, we think, oh, what a bunch of idiots. I mean, 1600 years ago, people were traveling, you know, by camel, by horseback, walking to get there to touch the black stone. Guess what? This year, over 2 million people will travel to Mecca to touch the black stone. That's one of the highlights of the pilgrimage. That was the big draw. Muhammad led a quiet and uneventful life. He was not an outgoing person by any accounts. He wasn't a mover or shaker. He was very quiet and withdrawn. I had a cousin like him. My parents always said, you need to spend more time with Charlie. And I said, I might become like him. I won't spend more time with Charlie. And I didn't, because I was a very selfish young man. But it was the right choice. But Muhammad grew up, he got married, still very quiet, very withdrawn. You wouldn't even notice this guy. He fancied himself a musician and a poet. And every year, for 1 or 2 months, he'd leave town and go up to the Hiva Mountains. The Hiva Mountains are a small mountain range right outside of Mecca. Now, these aren't the Rocky Mountains, but they're big enough. They're big enough. They have caves in them. And every year, Muhammad would go up to the Hiva Mountains, find a cave, and sit in that cave for about a month or two. And he'd write poetry. He would write music. He would meditate. You know, there's nothing like the smell of fresh bat guano in the morning to get those juices flowing. And then he'd come back into town. Well, on one of those excursions, now known as the Night of Power, this is the Night of Power that Muslims talk about, Gabriel appeared to Muhammad. Yeah, that Gabriel, the biblical Gabriel. There's a lot of borrowing from the Bible in Islam. And Gabriel just flashed into that cave, and he took Muhammad and he said, you, sir, are the messenger of God. And then, pow, he's gone. What a message. If that happened to me, if that happens to me tonight, my life changes. Your life changes. Muhammad's life nearly ended because Muhammad thought he was crazy. Muhammad thought that he had been possessed by an evil spirit. He thought he had been possessed. Actually, what they call them was jinns. The Muslims in that time, well, they weren't Muslims back then, but the people back then believed in the existence of the jinn. The jinn were spirits, and a jinn could be a good spirit, a jinn could be a bad spirit. Well, Muhammad thought he got a hold of some bad jinn. And he thought, thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. That's why I only do one show. Muhammad thought he was possessed by one of the bad jinns. He thought he was crazy. So he thought, well, what am I going to do? How do you get rid of a jinn? Muhammad thought the only way you get rid of a jinn is you climb up to the highest cliff, you jump off, you're dead, jinn's gone. You know something? That might have been the best course of action. Unfortunately, he decided, first I'll go home and tell my wife goodbye. I don't want her to just worry. So he went home and he said, look, you know, I've gone crazy. I'm possessed by a jinn, and I thought I saw an angel, and the angel said I was the messenger of God, and now I got to go kill myself. And his wife, being a very resourceful woman, said, you're not crazy. You are the messenger of God. if I came home tonight and told my wife I was the messenger of God, you know, she'd say, you know, go to the Hiva Mountains. Jump. No. You are crazy. You're not the messenger of God. But Muhammad's wife didn't do that. Guys, if you're going to marry, find a girl who gives you that kind of unwavering support. Find a girl who will just go along with whatever you say. Your life will be dull. You'll make a lot of mistakes, but hey, at least you won't argue. Muhammad continues to go back to the mountain. Every year, for 2 years, he goes back to the mountain. He goes back to the same cave. Nothing. No more appearances. Gabriel's just blowing him off. Not a letter, not a note, not a card, no flowers. It sounds like one of my sister's old boyfriends. Finally, after 2 years, bang, Gabriel's back in the cave. Muhammad's so glad to see him. Gabriel's glad to see him. And Gabriel said, so what have you been doing the last 2 years? And Muhammad said, waiting for you. Gabriel said, I've got more news. And Gabriel starts to tell Muhammad the secrets of God, how there is only one God. Hey, that's not bad theology. But he tells him about this God. He's a terrible, vengeful God who's angry at everyone all the time, and you can't talk to this God. He tells Muhammad that he has to go and preach the gospel of this God in Mecca, that he has to convert the world. And Muhammad's a little timid, but he goes down into town, tries to speak a little bit, doesn't go so well. He's quiet for another year. He goes back. Gabriel comes back to him and says, how'd that go? Muhammad said, not so well. Gabriel said, you want to go to hell? Muhammad said, no. Gabriel said, here's some more messages. Get on down there. For 10 years, Gabriel appears to Muhammad on a regular basis, always in a cave, always when Muhammad's alone, always when nobody else notices. But Gabriel keeps feeding him this information. And the more information Muhammad gets, the bolder he gets. And the bolder he gets, the more he evangelizes in Mecca. And the more he evangelizes, the more he alienates most of the people of Mecca. Because they don't want to hear this, especially not that whole one God thing, because Mecca's tourism industry is based on multiple gods. But for 10 years this goes on. And gradually Muhammad's getting a following. Oh, they're kind of the wretched refuse of Mecca, but he's getting a following. Finally, on one night, and this was really the night that kind of culminated all these visits, Gabriel comes to Muhammad in the cave and says, road trip. And Muhammad's like all of us. We all like a road trip. I like a road trip. And so Gabriel puts Muhammad on a flying donkey. And he takes Muhammad on the flying donkey. And in fact, if you look at Islamic literature in their illustrated stories, you will see a man on a flying donkey. That's Muhammad. That's the flying donkey. Gabriel flies Muhammad and the flying donkey over to Jerusalem. They tie up the donkey, and then they go up through heaven. Actually, they go to the seven heavens. This is where our phrase, or our saying, go to the seventh heaven. And Gabriel takes Muhammad through seven different heavens. Actually, he only takes them through six, because nobody can get up to the seventh heaven. Each heaven is ruled over by a prophet. Not a bad gig. And each heaven gets better and better. Although, you know, once you make heaven, to me, it's like being a fool. You know, you're a fool, you're a fool. You don't need to be more fool. You know, you're in heaven. Do you need a better one? Adam has the first heaven. See, you didn't even know Adam was a prophet. Then our second heaven was ruled over by Abraham. Our third heaven was ruled over by Moses. Are any of these names striking a bell? Our fourth heaven was ruled over by David. Our fifth heaven was ruled over by Jesus. Sixth heaven, empty. Seventh heaven, God. Every heaven got better and better. And they went through all the heavens. They got up to this sixth heaven, and this sixth heaven was really great. And Muhammad said, there's no prophet to rule over it. And Gabriel said, babe, that's yours. This is reserved. Look, there's a sign on the door. It says, Muhammad's heaven. And when you die, this is your heaven. You are the last and the greatest prophet. And your prophecies, your teachings will complete, supersede, and perfect the teachings of every prophet that came before you. You see, when Adam was the only prophet, his teachings ruled. But when Abraham came along, his teachings superseded, completed, and perfected all of Adam's teachings. And then Moses came along and overruled Abraham. David, Jesus was best. But then Muhammad came along and his teachings overruled even the teachings of Jesus Christ. After this, this was in 620. This was in 620. Muhammad came back and his ego had reached massive proportions. He began to get almost militant in his teachings. And finally, the town fathers of Mecca said, you know something, this guy's not just a pest anymore, he's a threat. And they booted him and all his followers out. And for the next 12 years, there was constant warfare. Muhammad and his little group of ingrates camped out about 20 miles away from Mecca in a little town. And they'd come up and they'd attack Mecca. And the guys from Mecca would beat them all away. And then the guys from Mecca would go down and attack the little town. Finally, they reached a treaty. And they said, okay, you know, you don't bother us, we don't bother you. To celebrate this in 632, this treaty, Muhammad said to his guys, okay, we're all going to go back. We're going to make a pilgrimage up to Mecca. We're all going to come back. It'll be like, you know, Muhammad Day or something. And we're all going to go in and pray through the streets of Mecca. Well, just as they get to the gate of Mecca, Muhammad stops and, according to legend, says, your Islam is complete, and drops dead. He probably said something like, and just dropped dead. But that doesn't make a good story of your prophet. You want your prophet to go out on a high note. You want him to prophesy something like his own death, not just, oh, you know, here's the big one, and he's over. No. According to the legend, it's your Islam is complete, face down. And he's dead. He's dead. And the history of the cult of Islam from that day forward has been one of infighting and murder and bloodshed. Almost immediately, there's a power struggle. And we don't have time to go into it. But there was a power struggle. People, different groups were attacking each other. Guess what? They're still doing it today. Iraq is nothing but a group of warring Islam. If we left Iraq today, war wouldn't cease. They'd all just kill each other. It's the truth. They've been doing it for centuries. They hate each other. Their own little sects hate each other as much as they hate us, the non-believers. It would be like if we said, okay, everybody get a gun, we're taking on the Methodists. You know? Where's the rationale? You know? How's that play out? Where's the love? Where's the love? People like to pitch Islam as being a religion of peace and love. And on its surface, it is. Muhammad was a poet and had a lot of pretty poetry and a lot of things about love and acceptance. Here's one of his nice poems. It's kind of free verse. It doesn't rhyme. Invitation first. That is, call men to Islam. If they refuse, then war. The sword is the key of heaven and hell. A drop of blood shed in the cause of Allah is of more avail than 2 months of fasting or prayer. Whoever falls in battle, his sins are forgiven. And at the day of judgment, his limbs shall be supplied by the wings of angels and cherubim. So if you die fighting, you're home free. You see, we don't grasp that mindset. That's why we're not doing real well in that part of the world, because we don't grasp that life means nothing to them. It's based on this teaching. Okay, that's where they came from, but what do they believe? Islam centers around 5 pillars of faith or theology and 5 pillars of practice. And we've got about 15 or 20 minutes to cover 10 pillars. Do the math. The first pillar of faith or practice is God. And I'm not going to talk about the difference between Islam and Christianity. You know, I'm not going to go about those 5 denials because it's pretty obvious as we go through this. If it's not obvious to you, see Jonathan Anderson after this class. You really are missing something. This is pretty obvious stuff. God. There is no God but God. Often you'll hear when people are referring to Islam, they'll say there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his prophet. That's incorrect. A good Muslim will never say the word Allah. It's like an Orthodox Jew saying Yahweh. Allah is that big name. You never use the big name for Allah. Islam teaches that God has 99 names, and he who knows the 99 names will enter paradise. Actually, God has 100 names, but the 100th name is secret. The problem is that 100th name is Allah, and like everybody knows it. What kind of a secret is that? You know? I mean, that's the secret name? I know it. And I'm not an Islam. I'm not a Muslim. I guess that means I get into paradise. But I don't know the other 99. Maybe that's the password. Maybe that's really the only one we need. A good Muslim will wear, when they pray, they will wear a necklace of 99 beads so that they can count as they name each name of God. They can count it off on the necklace. Can you imagine how frustrating it is when you get to about 95 or 96 and you're thinking, you know, Bobby? You know, I mean, you're just trying to come up with four more because you're going to start all over again. You know, after a while, you're just kind of figuring, you know, Chuck, or you're moving two beads at a time. You know, anything. The entire basis of a Muslim's relationship with God is one of appeasement. God is angry all the time. Allah is always mad. And you don't know why he's mad. He's just mad. And you don't know what it takes to make him happy. All you can do is follow the five pillars of faith and the five pillars of practice closely enough. Deny yourself. Dedicate yourself. And maybe someday Allah will take you out of hell, which is where we all go, will take you out of hell and bring you into paradise. The problem is nobody knows how many things you have to do. Nobody knows how many good things you have to do to get Allah's favor, because Allah hates you. Allah hates you. Yeah, Allah hates you. You know, that would be a terrible thing. Why would you worship a God that hated you? Why would you worship a God that is constantly angry with you? You know, it's the insanity, the illogic of a cult that you would honestly spend your life serving a God that is just looking to stick you in the back the first time he gets a chance. That's their God. They claim that Allah is the same God that's talked about in the Old Testament and New Testament. So if you talk to them about the Bible, those portions of the Bible that they adopt, they say, well, yeah, it's the same God. They just call him Yahweh and El Shaddai and all those things. But after all, he's got 99 names. That's the same God. That's the same God. But again, that's not the God that is pictured in the Old Testament and New Testament. They believe in the Psalms. They say the Psalms of David are referring to this Allah. Where do you get this angry God who hates you all the time? Out of the Psalms of David. It doesn't make sense. There is no Trinity. There is no Holy Spirit. There is no Son of God. You really want to make them mad? Talk about Jesus Christ as the Son of God. My youngest son last year, his senior year at OU, took a course in Islam. And his teacher was a devout Muslim. And she would always talk about there is no conflict between Christianity and Islam. Islam accepts the teachings of Christianity. Islam accepts all teachings. We believe, you know, that Christians worship the God, and he's the same God of the Old Testament and New Testament. And Benjamin said, well, but you say there's blasphemy. And she said, well, no, we accept everything. Benjamin said, I say Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He is the Son of God. I say Jesus Christ is God. Now, you think I'm a blasphemer. And finally she had to say, you're blaspheming. There is no Son of God. Here's a little quote. They do blaspheme who say God is Christ, the Son of Mary. They do blaspheme who say God is one of three in a Trinity, for there is no God except one God. If they do not desist from their blasphemy, a grievous penalty will befall them. I don't think they're saying in-school suspension. When they're talking about grievous penalty. The problem is they call Jesus the second greatest prophet who ever lived. And Jesus Christ said he was the Son of God. And Jesus Christ said he is God. But they say, no way. So the first pillar is a detached, judgmental God who is to be feared and appeased, not loved, and he can only be arbitrarily satisfied. The second pillar of faith is their authority. There are four, and I think I wrote them down for purposes of brevity, or for time. Did I write them down on your outline? Good. Then I won't bother to put them on the board. There are four inspired books in Islam. Torah. That's the Torah of Moses. Yeah, you know, burning bush Moses. Baby in the basket. You know, Moses. There's Moses. First five books of the Bible. Those are inspired. The Psalms of David. Again, like I say, every time you see God in the Psalms, they just see Allah. The Gospel of Jesus, but only selected part. It's like the Reader's Digest version of the teachings of Christ. cutting out all that whole stuff about I and the Father am one, you know, anything that's kind of inconvenient. And, of course, the Quran. The Quran means the reading or the recitation. Muslims hold that those first three, the Torah, the Psalms, and the Gospel of Jesus, have been corrupted over time, that they have been mistranslated, that parts have been lost, and therefore they're not really reliable. The Quran came last, according to Muslims, and therefore it is the most reliable. It supersedes, perfects, and completes all that came before it. And so it can be trusted. The Quran's shorter than the New Testament. It's about four-fifths the size of the New Testament. And interestingly enough, according to Islam, the Quran is God speaking in the first person. So everything is I, me. It's like if your whole Bible was written in red letters. That's what the Quran is like. It's all written in first person. It's all actually God saying me. It's dictating. It's not inspired. It's dictated. Here's the problem. Here's the problem. When Muhammad died, nobody saw it coming. Muhammad didn't see it coming. Nobody saw it coming. And the Quran didn't exist. And after he died, his followers got together and said, he's dead, and we don't really have like a book. And so they scattered. And they started collecting writings of Muhammad. And they collected over 800. The problem is fewer than 50 of these writings were actually written by Muhammad. The rest of them were all written by people who heard him, or people who studied under him, or people who had heard of him and written their own kind of interpretation. So what's that about? 85-90% of the Quran was accumulated from sources other than Muhammad. When they compiled it, they wrote it all down just using consonants, no vowels. Now, you know, if you look at any book and you take out all the vowels, all the A, E, I, O's, and U's, if you don't know what it says, you probably won't be able to figure it out. But that's how they wrote the Quran. No vowels, just consonants. And it stayed that way till 1924. It caused a lot of confusion. Well, in 1924, a group of Egyptian Islamic scholars got together and said, you know, we're going to fix this once and for all. And they got together, and for about 3 years, they redid the Quran. They inserted all the vowels, which is a good idea. It makes it an easier read. The problem is some words, especially in the Aramaic, vary differently in meaning just by, do I put an A here, an E here, or an I here? The word for master is one with an E. If you put an I in, it's servant. And if you put an A in, it's slave. And they have nothing to go on. They try to read the context. They try to think of what makes the best sense. But after 3 years, they came up with this final Quran. The Quran in its present-day form has only existed since 1927. Try to tell a Muslim that the next time they talk about the timeless Quran. 1927, baby. You know, that World War I's over, World War II's on the way, the stock market hasn't even crashed. You know, we're talking 80 years? That's timeless? If that's true, my mother's timeless. She's 83. You know, my mother is older than the Quran. I think I'll point that out to her next time I see her. You know, Mom, you are older than the Quran. Hardly the timeless epic. So we have an angry God and an 80-year-old Bible. Third, angels. The existence and work of angels is much more detailed. It's very detailed in Islam, so much more so than Christianity. You know, if you go through the Bible and you look at angelology, there's not really a lot said. They're the messengers of God, but there's not a whole lot said about angels. And you know why that is? Because it ain't really that important to your life or mine, quite frankly. People try, there's kind of a movement over the last 10 years, it's starting to die out. Angelology got real hot. And people were talking about angels, wearing little angel pins. You know something? It ain't that much, baby. You know, if God really thought that the work of angels was crucial to our lives, he would have talked a whole lot more about it. The Bible tells us what we need to know to the extent we need to know it. But in Islam, the work of angels, the existence of angels, is much more detailed. And it makes sense because they have a very detached God that they can't approach and they can't know. And so the angels kind of become the intermediary. That's the closest they can get to having contact with God. Four main angels. Gabriel, that's the big angel, that's the chief angel, that's the big dog, that's the one who's talking to Muhammad. Israfel, he's the guardian of the human ability to think and reason. I think he should have come to talk to Muhammad instead of Gabriel. You know, bring him reasoning, help him think. The third one is Israel. Israel is my favorite angel. He's the angel of death. Here's how death works. Your heart stops beating and you fall down. But here's how it works otherwise. Are you out there? Are you out there? Because I'm up here. Here's how it works. Under the throne of Allah, a tree grows. It's the tree of life. The tree has innumerable leaves. Every leaf contains the name of one person on earth. Your name is on a leaf, on the tree of life that grows under the throne of Allah. My name. I have my own leaf. Here's the problem. Every day after sunset, the angel of death, Israel, goes around. He takes a basket. He flies under the tree of life, and he picks up the leaves that have fallen from the tree that day. And he looks at those leaves. And 1 month from that day, you die. Sleep tightly tonight. Your leaf may be in a basket. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying it might be. And of course, the last one is Al-Shaytan. Al-Shaytan, the devil. The devil is an angel who was kicked out of heaven because he refused to bow down. And we know that story. The devil was kicked out of heaven because he refused to bow down and worship Adam. That's what they tell us. He didn't have any problem with Allah. He refused to worship Adam. So much for that whole little created a little lower than the angel stuff. We each have two guardian angels. They follow us around all our lives. They each have a book. One copies down all the good things we do. One copies down all the bad things we do. That's not a guardian. That's an informant. That's a spy. You know? A guardian angel is the guy that pushes you out of the way of the car. These angels don't do that. They just follow you around, ready to rat you out at a moment's notice. They have a close relationship with their angel because they have no relationship with their God. All right, finally, prophets. There are six and only six prophets in the history of mankind. We named them before. Adam, Abraham, Moses, David, Jesus, and Muhammad, in that order of importance. Each one of them supersedes, perfects, and completes the teachings of the prophets that came before them. There's only six. Prophecy closed with Muhammad. So if you kind of checked off, you know, at school, if they say, what would you like to be when you grow up, and you check prophet, think again. I hope you had a second choice. I hope you had a fallback position. Prophets closed. Finally, last days, eternity. The last day is going to be a time of resurrection and judgment. See, everybody except prophets and martyrs, when they die, go into the grave and they stay there. They don't go to heaven, they don't go to hell. Unless you're a prophet or a martyr, then you go to heaven. But everybody else goes to the grave and they lay there waiting for the day, for the final day of judgment. Here's the spooky thing. You know you're dead. You know you're in a grave. And just laying there waiting. I'm claustrophobic. That would just drive me nuts. I would be a zombie because I would claw my way out of there. They don't believe in zombies. I do. We'll edit this. We'll edit this tape. So they lay there waiting for the last day, for the day of judgment. Finally, Jesus Christ comes from his fifth heaven. Because he couldn't get into the sixth heaven, and he sure couldn't get into the seventh heaven. He comes down from his fifth heaven, he returns to earth, and he defeats the beast. Yes, the beast of Revelation. And the whole world, everybody who's alive, becomes a Muslim. And they all live happily ever after. And all the dead people are resurrected. They have an actual resurrection of the dead. And all the non-Muslims go to hell. What do you want? You know, we're not Muslim. Where are we supposed to go to heaven? All the Muslims go to hell. And I think there's some inherent injustice about that. I mean, you work hard all your life, you obey Allah and you go to hell, but everybody except prophets and martyrs go to hell, even if you're a Muslim. Now, here's the difference. You go to hell, but if you're a Muslim, you eventually get out and go to one of the heavens. And which heaven you go to is based supposedly on what you do while you're alive on earth. But if that was the case, if you were really good, why would you have to go to hell in the first place? We never get out of hell. But the good news is, eventually we're annihilated. So there's no eternal punishment, but there's no heaven either. How about that? So those are the six pillars of theology. An arbitrary God, a haphazard scripture, glorification of angels. Prophets whose prophecies can't be verified because, you know, the Torah, the Psalms, the writings of Christ, those have all been contaminated. A temporary heaven and a layered hell. What's not to like? Now, which heaven you get into eventually depends on how good you are and how hard you work on earth. In 6 minutes, here's the five things you have to do, the five pillars of practice. The first one's the Shahada, testifying. Now, I don't mean evangelism. This isn't you go out and talk about how good Islam is. It's a statement of faith. Here's the statement of faith. I testify that there is no God but God, and I testify that Muhammad is the messenger of God. Hey, if I was starting a cult, I'd throw me in there too. You know, I testify, I say there's no God but God, and Tom Beswick is his prophet. You know, I testify there is no God but God, and you better not make him mad if you mistreat Tom Beswick. You know, you throw yourself in there as often as possible. It's like, there is no God but God, and your name here is his prophet. You know, that's what all Muhammad did. It's a statement of faith. If you say that with the intention of becoming a Muslim, you're a Muslim. You don't have to walk down an aisle. You don't have to be baptized. You're a Muslim. All you have to do is say, okay, I want to be a Muslim, and I testify there is no God but God, and Muhammad is just, oh, maybe I'm a Muslim now. Yeah. Yeah. All right, I'll go jihad on you. All right. This shahada is whispered in the ear of every newborn by his or her father as soon as they're born. It's to be the first words the child hears. Through the life of a Muslim, they will repeat that literally thousands and thousands of times as their angel writes it down in their book. Ideally, it's the last sentence a Muslim ever speaks on this earth or ever hears. So when there's a suicide bomb, guess what they are chanting as they walk in to detonate? I testify there is no God but God, and I testify that Muhammad is the messenger of God. If you're at Northeast Mall, if it's a crowded day, and in the crowd you hear, I testify there is no God but God, run. Get to the Gap. You know, get to Dillard's, run. Yeah, you might look stupid, but you might be the only one alive afterwards. Second, the Salat, the prayer. Prayer is very ritualistic with a Muslim. They do it five times a day, morning, noon, afternoon, and night. These people are prayer warriors. Five times a day. You think that's not so bad? Here's the prayer. You know, you don't even have to make up your own prayer. You ever been praying? You think, what am I going to pray about tonight? If you're a Muslim, you don't have to worry. Here's what you pray. God is great. I witness that there is no God but God. I witness that Muhammad is a messenger of God. You know, the guy is just self-promotion. Rise up for prayer. Rise up for salvation. God is great. There is no God but God. The end. They don't say the end, but that is the end. There is no God but God. They have to say that five times a day. Okay? And the more, now that's all you have to really say it is five times a day. But the more times you say it, the better off it is. Because your angel's writing it down. So write it right around. You know, you think five times a day is a lot. It's not. When Muhammad went on that trip to heaven, he met with Allah briefly, and Allah told him he wanted everybody to pray 50 times a day. Well, that kind of took Muhammad back a little bit, and he's going down out of the heavens, and he gets to Moses' heaven. And Moses says, what are you upset about? And Muhammad says, 50 times a day? I can't get people to pray 50 times a day. Moses said, get back up there. Cut a new deal. Go on, talk to them, because I know people. I know people that are not going to pray 50 times a day. Muhammad goes back up. He negotiates. He comes back down. Moses said, how'd it go? He said, I'm down to 30. And Moses said, that's not going to sell. And Muhammad said, what am I going to do? He said, you're going to get back up there. You're going to cut a new deal. And this kept repeating until he finally got down and came down. And Moses said, how many? He said, five. He said, I think that's the best you're going to do. Go. And that's how we arranged it, five. True story. That's how they arranged it, five. You know, you think those things are kids. That's the story of how five times came. But it is a lot better than 50. Zakat. Z-A-K-A-T. Alms. Needing, helping the needy. It's a mandatory tax of about 2.5% on all liquid assets. So anything you have in the bank, you pay 2.5%. Goes into a fund. When our government boys started to track back the funding for terrorist attacks in this country and around the world, guess where much of the money came from? The zakat. The benevolence. They traced it back to these benevolence funds. They've been used to fund terrorism throughout the world. You can give more than 2.5%, and every additional amount you give goes toward atoning for sins. So, you know, you're rich. You can live quite a loose lifestyle. Saum, S-A-U-M, reflecting and fasting. This is where Ramadan comes in. 1 month. Now, Islam preaches temperance. They don't preach self-abuse, he said. As you open the Dallas Morning News today, and on the front page, and you probably can't see this in the back, but there's a picture of a bunch of half-naked Muslims. And it says, Shiite Muslims in Iran beat themselves Tuesday in annual rites for Asherah to mourn the 7th century decapitation of Hussein, a relative of the Prophet Muhammad. Every year they get together and beat themselves for Asherah. You know, there is no God, but Asherah is a moon goddess. Depending on your sect within the cult of Islam, there are goddesses. There is no God, but Asherah is his sister. Ramadan, 1 month a year is Ramadan. And they set it aside for a time of fasting and meditation. The timing is based on the lunar moon. They have a lunar calendar. Here's how they figure it out. Ramadan begins at sunset after the first sighting of the new moon at the end of the previous month. So, watch for the new moon at the end of the previous month. You don't have to keep track of it. They have like three different groups of Islam, of Muslims around the world that actually set Ramadan every year. During Ramadan, the thought is that Satan is bound, that he is chained, that al-Shaitan is kept in chains, and that the gates of paradise are open for the blessings to pour forward. Not the blessings from Allah, because Allah doesn't bless anybody, but the prophets of each heaven pour out blessings on the faithful. That's Ramadan. During Ramadan, they fast from dawn until sunset. No eating, no drinking, no smoking, nothing that we might find fun. At the end of the month, it's over. But you can fast longer. And if you know what's good for you, you will. Because your angel is watching. Finally, the Hajj, H-A-J-J, the pilgrimage. Every Muslim must make one pilgrimage to Mecca during their lifetime. Got to. Now, if you're too old or too sick, you can hire somebody to make the pilgrimage for you. And that counts as your pilgrimage. Here's the downside. If you make the pilgrimage, every step you take in that pilgrimage atones for one sin you committed. That's why if you see pictures of Muslim pilgrims, you'll see they're all walking. Nobody's riding. Nobody's driving a car around Mecca. Nobody's riding a bike around Mecca because those miles don't count. The only distances that count are the distances that are walked. And people literally go there. The pilgrims go there and walk till they drop. They walk and walk and walk, and they carefully count their steps. I don't know why they count their steps. They've got two angels doing that. It's a week of festivities. You can really do this any time, but usually around Ramadan, that's the big time for the big pilgrimage. That's when the biggest crowds show up. And they have all sorts of organized tours. You go through the Kaaba, and you circle the black stone counterclockwise, and then you circle it clockwise. And if you can touch it, that gets you extra points. Literally, for 1 week, these people do nothing but walk. They are walking their way to atonement. Isn't that an interesting concept? You know, not by works of righteousness, which we have done. Don't tell that to a Muslim. They're walking their way to heaven. They're walking. Every step counts as atonement for one sin. Look at that. Testifying, praying, giving your money, fasting, and a pilgrimage. And every one of the five pillars of practice has as its end goal entry into paradise. You're literally paying your way in with every breath you take. The five pillars of faith, the five pillars of practice. You know, can you imagine getting up every day for the rest of your life and knowing that your entry into heaven depends on you? I mean, think about that. If you laid in bed when that alarm clock went off, or when your mom or dad yelled up that you really had to get up and this was the last time they were going to tell you, and you laid there staring at the wall and you thought, you know, whatever I do today determines if I go to heaven or hell. What a burden that would place on you. What a burden that would place on your conduct, on your merit. And that is the life of every Muslim. Every day when they wake up, eternity rides on their shoulders. Eternity rides on their ability to appease a God they cannot know, to appease a God they cannot please. That is the sorry lot. And you know, that's really the burden the law placed on the shoulders of mankind. If we were to go back to the Old Testament and read the law placed an impossible burden. God said, well, here's my perfect law. You want to please me? You want to earn your way into heaven? Here's all you have to do. Keep this law perfectly and you're in. And every day, every man, every Israelite woke up, and if they had a knowledge of the law, they knew that their merit, their entry into heaven, rested on their shoulders. Jesus knew the hopelessness of that. And you know, Matthew 11:28-30, he said, here's the option. Here's the option. He said, come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. My yoke is easy, my burden is light. And you know something? We all want that. We're all looking for an easy yoke and a light burden. And that's what the Bible teaches. That's what the gospel of Jesus Christ teaches. A light yoke, an easy burden. When you talk, or if you talk to a Muslim, you know, it's easy to get drawn into confrontation. It's easy to get drawn into politics instead of theology. They don't need to argue politics. You don't need to argue politics. When I talk to someone who is in the Islam faith, I usually talk about the easy yoke, the light burden that Jesus Christ offers. That's the good news. That's the good news for you. That's the good news for me. That's the good news for everyone caught in the cult of Islam. It's the Roman road to salvation. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. The wages of sin are death. But God commendeth his love toward us, and that while we're yet sinners, Christ died for us. That's what they need to hear. That's what we need to tell them. Well, let's close in prayer real quickly, and then I think you're going to go to your groups. Lord God, we thank you for your easy yoke and your light burden. Lord, may we never lose sight of the fact that we could never do anything to merit entry into paradise. We thank you that you have removed that requisite from us. And Lord, as you give us opportunities to meet with people who are struggling, who are tied into cults such as Islam, Lord, may you recall to our minds the teachings of Christ. May you recall to our minds, Lord, the easy burden and the light yoke. May we share that good news with all that we come into contact with, and we pray this in your name.